Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Saha Deryam Karavavahai Tejasvinapati Tamastu Mavidvishavahai Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.
We're in verse 191.
Rago lingam abodhasya, rago lingam abodhasya, santuraga dayo pude,
iti shastra dvayam sartam,
iti shastra dvayam sartam,
evam satya virodhataha,
evam satya virodhataha,
virodhataha,
virodhataha.
Okay. Ragaha. Lingam abodhasya santu ragadayaha buddhe iti shastra dvayam sartam evam sati avirodhataha. Raga dvesha. Ragaha. Raga means the passion towards something, for something, the like for something. Sometimes raga dvesha, we say likes and dislikes. So here raga, just say raga, it stands for raga dvesha, like the positive and the negative. So ragaha lingam abhodasya. Raga, raga dvesha, your likes and dislikes, they are a lingam. They point to abhoda, ajnanam. Right? Bodha is knowledge. Abhoda, right? Jnanam, ajnanam, bodha, abodha. So, raga, dvesha, your likes and dislikes. I need this, the whole desire template, I need this in order to be happy. That raga is a linga, it's a marker for ajnanam, abodhasya.
What does linga mean?
Lingam is a, like in a hetu, in a logical syllogism, the linga is what makes something else to be recognized. Like, for instance, if I say, this is an example of a linga. If I say, look, there's a fire on the hill. Why? Not because I see the fire, but because I see the smoke. Right. So what if I say, look, there's a fire on the hill, see the smoke? Right?
Mm-hmm.
The smoke is a linga for the fire. If you see the smoke, you know there's fire. So that's a linga. If you see a raga, you see the raga there, you know there's a jnanam. Okay, now, but we have to unpack this, okay?
Oh, okay?
This is a Shruti statement. Raga lingam abodhasya. There's another, that's one. Raga is a marker for a jnanam, for ignorance. But another Shruti says, santu ragadiha buddhe. Let there be raga, etc., in the wise person. Raga adya, rada, raga, etc. Raga dvesha, your passions, your likes and dislikes, your hatreds and your reactions, and all of these things, your raga dvesha. Let all of these things be buddhe. Just don't take hatreds and all that, just to keep it as raga dvesha. Let your raga, your likes and dislikes, let likes and dislikes, santu is imperative, let them be in the wise person. So, he says, these are contradictory, can be contradictory. So he says, iti shastra dvayam, these two shastric statements, sartam, have meaning. These two shastric statements have meaning, evam sati, when this is the case. I'll tell you what this is the case is. But it says, evam sati, when this is the case, these two statements have meaning because avirodhataha, because they're not contradictory. If what's been being unfolded is understood. What has been being unfolded is that, well, let me see if how they deal with the next verse, just a minute. Oh, let me just recap a little bit of the argument that's gone before and then what we're moving into. Is, no, so I'm just making you recollect it. Is self-knowledge the self-knowledge take place through the experience of the negation of duality? Does it take place, does the self-knowledge take place through the negation of duality or through the recognition of the self? Right? Through the negation of duality, the self-knowledge take place through the negation of duality, or is it for through the cognition, the recognition of the self? That's been the argument. And he went through several different iterations of this argument. He said, if knowledge takes place only through the negation of duality, then if you go to sleep, right, if you go to sleep, then you'll have knowledge, right? So it can't, because in deep sleep there is no duality, so you've negated the duality, you should wake up as a jnani. And of course we can look at yoga also. If you have a nirvikalpa samadhi through the practice of pranayama and meditation techniques and whatnot, learning how to withdraw your mind and your sense organs completely, and then kind of totally resolve the mind or bring the mind into complete stillness, you can have a nirvikalpa experience, a non-dual experience. Even for people who have taken drugs, through drugs you can have a non-dual experience. If that, and that non-dual is the negate, non-dual means you've negated from your experience duality. So in deep sleep or in a drugged state or through pranayama or meditative exercises, you can dismiss duality. If that were enough, when you come back from that dismissal of duality, that non-dual state, you should be free. That should be the end of it. But that isn't the case. When you wake up from deep sleep, you're the same Agnani as you were before. When you wake up from, or when you come out of a non-dual experience also, if it's something that was just generated through activity, through drugs or through meditation or whatever, you come back from that experience, you know that was a wonderful experience. You can even say, this is the truth, this is what the truth is. But then you will also have to say, and I want to know what that truth is. See what I mean? You'll say, and I heard this, this is the truth, I know it's the truth, I want to know what this truth is. Right? You still don't have self-knowledge. So the negation of duality will not give you self-knowledge. So then he went on with another idea. Well, maybe it's self-knowledge involves both the negation of duality and the positive cognition of yourself, that you need both of them there. And then he goes to kind of that kind of strange argument that we were talking about, where he says, well, if both are needed, then a pot should have at least half knowledge. A pot should have half knowledge. And in fact, the pot would be better off than you are, because for the pot, of course, being inert, has no experience of duality. All that is there is the aparoksha atma, really. There's no experience of duality at all for the pot. So the pot's better off than you are, because you have mosquitoes and everything buzzing around. Literally, he says, in this experience of duality, the mosquitoes and whatnot are distracting you. And so you're not going to be as well off as a pot in terms of the gaining knowledge. But then he says, so that's not going to work either. And then he says, but then if you say that, okay, to gain knowledge, what you have to do is recognize yourself, have a cognition of the self, have a self-recognition of the Atma, then he says, be happy, because now you're starting to understand. Now you're coming over to my side of the fence, he says. So after saying that, then he says, then that being the case, if to gain that knowledge you need to gain antikarana shuddhi, purity of mind, and to stop the evil thoughts that you're having and whatnot, is literally what he says here, to get rid of the papas, you know, to work with mind to get rid of the papas, you go ahead and do that. That's no problem. Okay. Then from there he goes, doing all of that is to our advantage also, because in fact, that's acknowledging the Maya. Right? If we're working on ourselves, if we're working on the creation, if we have to deal with this creation, we are acknowledging Maya. So acknowledging Maya, you go ahead and work on yourself. What are you working on when you're working? What are you working on when you're working on yourself? You're not working on the Atma. You're not working on Brahman, right? You're working on the Upadi. You're working on the raga dveshas, the likes and dislikes that are there. You're working on all of the different complexes and different problems that we have. You're working on keeping your body healthy. All of this is all mitya. You're working on that. Okay, so we acknowledge this is all here, and you're acknowledging it also. And you're also acknowledging in the midst of all of this that is here, what is needed is to recognize myself. This is exactly what we say. Okay, so this is what he was dealing with. Now, then he says, the thing is, what we say, now he's going back to the very first verse of this chapter, which we're going to be dealing with now. He's going to the second line, and he says, the thing is, in this verse, ichan api agnivat na ichat kim ichan iti ishrutam. He says, when they say this na ichan in the verse, the jnani does not desire. What do they mean? Right? The jnani does not desire. What do they mean? They mean that the jnani does not desire in the same way that an ajnani desires. The jnani, the one who has self-knowledge, desires, but not in the same way that an ajnani desires. So we say, na ichan, the jnani doesn't desire anything in the same way that an ajnani desires. This is where the satyam mitya is going to come in. So this section is just a little confusing in a way, but I'll just try to tell you what it says in English. So now, this statement, the jnani doesn't desire in the same way that an ajnani desires, like this. This is what makes sense. Understanding this is what makes sense of these two shruti statements. Raga, ragaha lingam abodasya, which means desire is the marker of an ajnani, or for ignorance, for an ajnani. Okay, desire is the marker of an ajnani. Next statement, let desire, etc., be there for the jnani. They're contradictory. They're not contradictory if the satya mitya is understood. The jnani does not. And the prarabdha, remember, and prior to this, there was a whole statement, a whole unfoldment of the prarabdha karma. If you don't understand the mityatva of this creation, if you don't understand the prarabdha karma, all of these kind of standpoints, then there's no really way to understand what it means to have knowledge and to understand these two contradictory statements. So this is what it boils down to. When you gain knowledge of yourself, say if a positive cognition of the self is required to gain knowledge, what is entailed in that positive cognition of the self? Well, let me explain. I can negate this new. I can negate duality without a positive cognition of the self. In fact, I can have a nirvikalpa samadhi experience where there is only satchitananda there. Only conscious being there. But when I come back from that experience, let's put it this way. This is the problem right here. When the mind has the experience, the mind comes back from the experience. The mind that comes back from the experience is now commenting on the experience which it has had. Mm-hmm. Right? Now the question is, where is the ahankara? When the mind comes back from that non-dual experience or deep sleep experience, but let's take non-dual experience, it comes back from that non-dual experience. What does that mind have to say about the non-dual experience? Does the mind say, I, the mind, I, who am the mind, have had a non-dual experience, which is the truth. Do you see the problem? The mind comes back. The ahankara is still with the mind. The mind says, I have seen. I have had an experience of the truth. Now I've come back, and now I'm in duality. But I have had an experience of the truth. Right? And so now, where is the I residing? It's residing in the ahankara. See that? If the ahankara is residing in the mind, so the ahankara, the I, is the mind. If the I is the mind, then I am within duality. This is not mitya. Right? I am the jiva within the duality, within the creation, who has had the great fortune of having this experience of non-duality. So the dual mind has had an experience of the non-dual. Right? But the non-dual has gone away. The dual mind had an experience of the non-dual, but now the non-dual is not there. So this is not non-dual. Right? If the non-dual can come and go, that's a misnomer. When we say non-dual, like, the non-dual is either non-dual or it isn't. If you say non-dual, then there is no second thing. If you say non-dual, if you say the Atma, I am, for one who has self-knowledge, I am non-dual. I am non-dual, the Atma is non-dual. If I say the Atma is non-dual, what do I do? What is this creation? If I say I am non-dual, I might as well say I am this creation. Because there isn't room for a second thing once you say non-dual. It's non-dual. It's not non-dual and dual, because the dual would make the non-dual dual. Everybody see that? So if I say I am non-dual, or if I know myself, I have a cognition of myself, the creation has to be included in that cognition. You can't have a cognition of yourself that leaves out the creation. I don't know if those words are kind of complicated, actually. And so let me explain it again. I can't have to have knowledge of myself, I can't leave the creation behind in that recognition. Because if I leave the creation behind in that recognition, then there is myself and the creation as two separate realities, right? Myself and the creation. If there is myself and the creation, then that's Sankhya. That's duality. There's two now, right? And so to know myself, I have to know the Satya Mitya. I have to know myself as the self of the creation. It's like the wave in the wave ocean. The wave has to know that it is the water of the ocean. Not that the wave can't, this is the problem. The wave can't know and have knowledge, just say, myself is, the wave says, myself is the water. I am the water. That's not enough. It has to know that I am the water of the ocean. That's the truth of it, right? If it knows that I am water, then this is exactly Sankhya. This wave says, I am water, and this wave is water, and this wave is water, and this wave is water. That's why they said there are many, many Purushas. It's like saying there are many Brahmins, there are many Atmas. This wave is water, this wave is water. This wave is water. There are many, many different... All the waters are exactly the same, but there are many, many of them. That's dvaita. That's dual. Sankhya is dvaita. It's duality. Right? So I would say, you are the Atma. You are an Atma. You are an Atma. I am an Atma. And all of these Atmas are floating around in this prakriti, in this creation, which is different from me. Right? So there's no jnanam. There's no jnanam in that. So to understand myself is to understand that I am the self of the creation. That is the knowledge. But then you say, okay, I am the self of this creation, then what is the reality of this creation? Right? If I, the conscious being, and the truth of this creation, then what order of reality do we give to this creation, which I am the self of? Right? It can't have a separate order of reality. I mean, it can't be something real or separate from myself. This is exactly where the understanding of satyam mitya comes in. If you don't understand satyam mitya, then there can't be any such thing as saying, I am the self of this creation. You know, because this has some form of reality to it. So here, what he's going to say, let me just get to this to make this clear. First, we're going to move forward because this is what they're going to be talking about. So in this verse, in 191, he says, there's two contradictory statements. One is raga is the characteristic of an ajnani. It's the linga for an ajnani. The other one, it says, let raga and all of these things be there for ajnani. It doesn't make any difference at all. Right? These two statements, for these two shastric statements to have meaning, right? Then this satyam mitya, this understanding of satyam mitya has to be there, because then otherwise there would be contradiction. If this is understood, there won't be a contradiction. And so what is the language that we put this satyam mitya in, very simply, is that the raga, the desire that an ajnani experiences, is not the same desire that ajnani experiences. It is totally different. And the difference has to do with the satyam mitya. So let me just say in English exactly what the difference is. For an ajnani, the relationship between ananda, or fullness, and the mind is unknown. The ajnani doesn't know that the source of ananda is the atma. There's total ajnanam there. And so what that means for the ajnani is that the desires that I have for an object in the world are real. I need this object in order to be happy. Because I don't know that what is actually happening is that when I fulfill a desire, my mind relaxes and reflects the self like the sun reflected in a clear water bucket. I don't know that. And so all I know is the experience of the little experiences of ananda that I receive, the momentary experiences of ananda I receive from fulfilling the desire. That's the ajnani. The jnani also can fulfill a desire and get a quiet mind from the fulfillment of that desire and experience ananda in that quiet mind. The jnani can also have a quiet mind from contemplation, can have a quiet mind just because, reveling in the self, can have a quiet mind for lots and lots of reasons. But the difference is for the jnani knows all of that. The jnani knows what the source of the ananda is. The jnani has two different understandings, complementary understandings. One, the Atma is known. And so the Swarupa of your being is known. That ananda is ever-present. That is recognized. It's aprocha. What else is known is the psychodynamics of how ananda is generated by objects in the world or by experiences in the world. They know that whenever the mind is quiet, that mind reflects ananda and enjoys its own little experiences of happiness. And so, as a jnani, who's not really been asking much from the world, Vidyaranya went through this before, not even asking very much from the world at all, there's still little pleasures. There's a beautiful sunset. The stars are sparkling. The fire in your fireplace is nice. The music is beautiful. And the birds are chirping. Whatever. There's all kinds of little pleasures that the mind enjoys that gives different ripples and varieties of ananda. Because ripples and variety of relaxation in the mind. So does the jnani think, oh my gosh, all of these things, I need all of these things to keep these little ripples of ananda coming my way. He doesn't even think like that. There's no relationship between the objects in the creation and the ananda. The only relationship is kind of the refractory reflections of the quiet mind, right? Enjoying a different subtlety, different little subtle expressions of fullness and happiness, and enjoying subtle little expressions of unhappiness also. You know, your dinner is burnt, or this irritant has happened, or the traffic, you're in a traffic jam, and your mind goes, you know, does it mean anything? Well, these are raga dveshas. There's nobody inside building up on them, you know. But the mind is reflecting its own state. If the mind is enjoying a little bit of tension, then that tension is what's being experienced. If the mind is relaxed, that relaxation is being experienced, reflecting the ananda of the self. But all the while, your being is there. The Atma is there. Your self is there. That is stable. That ananda is stable. And so enjoying the ananda, the stability of yourself, these refractions of moods that are flickering, depending upon whatever the state of mind is, goes on happening. They go on happening. It's mithya. It's mithya. It doesn't mean anything. Because they're coming and going, changing, changing, changing. Just like the universe itself that you experience through your sense organs, it's changing, changing, changing. The mind's contact, the sensory contact with that, and the different contact of the different moods and emotions and ripples that are going on the mind are also happening. It's not like for the jnani the mind becomes totally flat or is just enjoying a state of samadhi from an ajnani's perspective. I'll tell you, in Aparochanubhuti, there Shankara is going to get into this. This walking around, he'll say, you know, does the jnani walk around in samadhi all the time? He says, yeah. Why? Not that there's not duality, not that there's not thoughts in the mind, but because the aparoksha atma is known, right? Yourself is known. Nothing is covering it. This is samadhi. Nothing is covering you, right? We think of samadhi as a non-dual experience, and we think of a non-dual experience as the removal of duality. This is his whole point. A non-dual experience is the removal of duality, like in deep sleep, or in nirvikalpa samadhi, where you get rid of the creation. That's what we think of samadhi. So Shankara is doing kind of a tongue-in-cheek on that. But it's also true, in this approach on the Buddha. It's also true what he has to say. There is no time that I'm not samadhi. I am the samadhi. I am the samadhi. This creation is not covering me or changing me in any way. I am the water in the ocean. I am the self, which is the self of this entire creation. Nothing can cover it at all, just like no amount of waves or storm can cover the water. It is the water. And so once the self has been recognized, it's impossible not to be in samadhi because there is no vritti that is anything other that has anything other than the self as its content. There's no object that has anything other than the self as its content. Right? Just like there's no wave that has anything other than water as its content. There's nothing that has, there's no experience in the creation that has anything other than you as its content. Once you have been once you've recognized yourself, and so that aparoksha atma is never not there. And that is who you are. And that is the ananda which all of the vrittis enjoy. When the vrittis enjoy ananda, though, they're what we call anandalesha. They're like refractions of ananda. Right? If they weren't refractions of ananda, think like this. A vritti enjoys a whole variety of emotional experience. Right? There are many, many types of emotional experiences. There's a whole gradation.
And so when you think of ananda in terms of the vritti, you think of grades of ananda: happier, happy, happier, happiest, blissful, compassionate, caring, fun, love, all of these words. You have all kinds of different words to, and nuance. You can nuances of the experiences of love and happiness and joy. You can nuance it, and we have vocabulary for that. Now, those nuances are changes, right? A nuance is a change. There are degrees of happiness, degrees of ananda, degrees of bliss. There aren't degrees of the Atma. Atma isn't sometimes happy, sometimes sad, sometimes happier, sometimes more blissful, sometimes less blissful. The Atma is always exactly the same. It's changeless. It's non-dual. It's called just pure consciousness. And so the Atma isn't becoming happier or more profoundly spiritual, you know, like it becoming profoundly high. The Atma is not becoming spiritually evolved.
Levels
of spiritual evolution. The Atma is always the same. Always the same. And so these nuances that you're talking about, or this maturing of ananda that you may be talking about, is fine. It belongs to the mind. These are states of mind, states of experience. The Atma is not a state of experience. And so here you are with a body, mind, sense organs in this creation, and you are here, the Aparoksha Atma, which is not changing, and then there's the Mitya, which is. There's the Aparoksha Atma, the immediate self that never changes in any way, that's illumining every state of experience that you have, that it's its own solid, stable being. And then there are all of the supravrittis and dukkavrittis, the ragas and the dveshas, all of these subtleties, all changing. Mitya, all of it is mitya. And so if you're thinking that you need a state of mind to recognize the Atma, that's not correct. Because all you're recognizing is a state of mind. You need to recognize what is there in every state of mind. Right? If you use a state of mind in order to, like for instance, this is what he's saying in the previous verse, go ahead and control your mind and do all of these things that you need to do to help you recognize the Atma. Control your mind, rein your mind back in, make your mind still so that the mind is in a position to differentiate itself, from your being. Go ahead and rein the mind in so that it can do that. But don't think, right, so that you can gain knowledge of yourself. The mind can gain knowledge of the stability of your being. You need to rein the mind in all of that. We accept all of that. So rein it in. But once you've reined it in, so that it can become quiet, so that it can make this differentiation, right, then you know, once you gain knowledge of yourself, then that knowledge, that self-knowledge, has nothing to do with the reined-in mind. It has to do with the removal of the ignorance that made you think that yourself was the mind. It's broken the ajnanam, the ignorance, that had caused you to identify the stability of your being with a different variety of vrittis in the mind. Happy vrittis and sad vrittis. I am happy, I am sad. Right? I am happy, I am sad. That is what makes a bhokta. It's where you are identifying, when you identify with a state of mind, that's what makes you an enjoyer. The Atma is not an enjoyer. What you're doing is the ahankara is identifying with a state of mind and saying, I am that. Say you have a happy state of mind. Your ahankara says, I am happy. Right? That makes you an enjoyer. The ahankara says, you have a dukkavritti, an unhappy state of mind. The ahankara says, I am unhappy. That's what makes you a dukkhi, an enjoyer. Right? The Atma is neither happy nor unhappy. The Atma is the Atma. It is always the same. And so for the jnani, the ahankara is resolved into the Atma. Right? I am the self. And a dukkha-vritti is a dukkha-vritti. A sukha-vritti is a sukha-vritti. That's what they are. I am not that. And yet, when a sukha-vritti is there, I can enjoy the sukha-vritti. Right? Because the sukha-vritti is the happy vritti is there. So I'm the experiencer of that as long as I have a mind. Dukkha-vritti is there. As long as I have a mind, I'm the experiencer of that. This body is there. As long as I have a body, I'm the experiencer of that body. As long as I walk to the store, I have a body and I walk to the store, I'm a karta. I'm walking to the store. But am I walking to the store? No. I'm walking to the store from the standpoint of the upadhi. That's the mitya. I am walking to the store. But that's a mitya. Right? Because at the same time I'm saying I'm walking to the store, karta, I'm saying I'm not walking to the store. That's the satya mitya. Right? The jnani knows this. The ajnani doesn't. For the ajnani, there is no satyam. There is no atma separate from the upadhi. The atma and the upadhi, the body, mind, sense organs, are one and the same thing. Right? And so there's no similarity, really, between the desire and the raga dveshas of the jnani and the raga dveshas, the likes and dislikes of an ajnani, because for the ajnani, there is no atma. Of course there's an atma, but there's no known differentiated atma. That makes everything is different. Then I am an individual in this creation trying to carve my happiness out of it. That's the ajnani. For the jnani, there's no such notion. And yet, I can be happy and sad. I can't be happy. Let me put it this way. The mind can be happy and sad. I can't say I'm happy and sad. I can't say that meaning that I am happy and sad, happy and or sad. If I say I am happy as a jnani, I'm talking about my mind being happy. Remember earlier Vidyaranya? He made this distinction. The language of an ajnani is different than the language of a jnani. The use of the ahankara is different. For the ajnani, it's when they say, I am happy, or I am this body, that ahankara enjoys an identity with the body. The atma and the body are one and the same. And so the I then is referring to the upadhi. For the jnani, the I is referring to the upadhi. When I say, I am going to the store, or I am happy or sad, it takes the upadhi as an upadhi, and the ahankara is referring to the upadhi. When the jnani is teaching, I am Brahman, then the ahankara is referring to the atma. The I is referring to the atma. Right? So the jnani talks about the upadhi as I and the atma as I, knowing exactly when the I is referring to the upadhi and when the I is referring to the atma. The ajnani doesn't have a differentiation between the upadhi and the atma. Mm-hmm. And so when the ajnani says I, they're talking about this individual person. The same here. That's just another way of saying the same thing. The jnani, when the jnani enjoys a desire, they understand completely the psychodynamics of it. The atma is not enjoying the desire. The atma is the ananda, which reflects in the mind, that allows that ananda to be in the mind. The ananda of the atma isn't something that comes and goes to enjoy in a desire. It's already there. The atma, the ananda of the atma is there before, during, and after the fulfillment of a desire. The atma, the ananda of the atma is there before, during, and after dukkha-vritti. That's what needs to be recognized. Right? And then you recognize what exactly is happening in terms of the mind's experience of ananda in reference to that. That's what you have to see. Okay, so, now he goes on to say, to elaborate, jagan mithyatvavat swatma sangatvasya samikshanat kasya kamayeti vachaha. Kasya kama yeti vachaha, bhoktra bhava vivakshaya. I had to break this Sunday kind of incorrectly, but I'll fix it now. J- jagan mityatvavat swa atma asangatvasya samikshanat kasya kamaya iti vachaha bhoktra abhava vivakshaya. Second line, kasya kamaya iti vachaha. The statement in the verse that we're working on, kasya kamaya, for whose desire? Kasya kamaya. Does one desiring what? And for the sake of whom? Does a jnani, somebody who knows the Atma, worry about the body, get it all overheated about, you know, get the good selves worked up? Desiring what and for the sake of whom does all of this take place? This statement, he says, vachaha, this statement is in order to show the bhoktra abhava, the non-existence of the enjoyer. Bhoktra abhava. So let's look at the top line. Jagan mityatvavat. Just like in gaining, this is in, for the one who gains knowledge, just like the jagan mityatva, recognizing that this whole creation is mitya, asangatva, swa-atma asangatvasya samikshanat. There's two things. What he's saying is here, there are two things. In gaining knowledge, there are two things to be understood. One is jagan mitya. But you can't understand the jagan mitya without understanding the asangatva of the Atma, of the Satchit Atma. If you understand the asangatva of the Atma, then you can understand the jagan mitya. When you understand these two things, then the Atma is no longer a karta, is no longer a bhokta. So let me just do a couple of minutes on that. So it says, samikshanat, from clearly understanding the asangatva of the Atma, like you understand the jagan mitya, the jagan mityatva, in the same way you have to understand both of these together, then understanding both of these, then what happens? You recognize that there is no such thing as a bhokta, that the Atma is not a bhokta, the Atma is not an enjoyer. Just quickly, let me just run this by you just quickly. There's a process of understanding that my mind has to go through to really grasp, to gain knowledge. I have to be able to recognize that this conscious being, this me that I am, is not actually contained by this body, mind, sense organs. That's what asanga means. Asanga literally means it isn't attached. It's not attached to anything. If it were attached to this body, then it would be stuck in the body. If it was attached to the mind, it would be stuck in the mind. You know, like pouring water in a pot, the pot holds the water. Well, this body, mind, sense organs can hold myself. Without this body, mind, sense organs, then myself wouldn't be here. Whatever illustration you want to use, you know. There's a sangha, an attachment. If you say that the Atma is a sangha, that's like saying, the Drishtanta we use, illustration we use for it, it's like saying the space in the universe, the space is a sangha. The space is not attached to anything. Everything exists in space, but space isn't attached to anything. Like, for instance, if I hold up this cup, and then I say, well, look at this cup. This cup has pots. There's cup space. This is cup space inside the cup, right? Cup space. But if I were, I would have to teach you. If you think that the space is being held by the cup, do you think that there's actually that this cup is holding space? Is it holding space, or is the space a sangha? Right? Mm-hmm. You'd say, this, no, really the space is a sangha, because actually when I move the cup from A to B, from this side to this side, I'm actually not moving the space. The cup is moving through space. Right? So the space is totally, is a sangha. It's unattached to the cup. And to think that the cup is holding the space is illusory. It's simply not true. even though we act like it's true, because actually there is space in here, but the space is actually pervasive to the cup. The space is asanga. Okay? So now, what if we say, the Atma is, yourself is asanga, like the space. The Atma is not attached to this body. It's not attached to the mind. It's not attached to the sense organs. It's not even attached to the ahankara, to the I thought. It's not attached to my moods. It's not attached to my emotions. It's not attached to my memories. It's not attached to my experiences. It's totally asanga. That's the vision that has to be conveyed. How do we convey that? How do we make you see that you are asanga? Okay. So there's teaching methodologies like the Drik Drisha. One, it's a very powerful teaching methodology because with the seer seeing methodology, what happens is that I start going through a process of objectifying myself step by step by step, because just like I can say as a body standing here, I am not attached to this chair. I'm sitting in the chair, but I could get up and leave it also. I'm not attached to any of you. It's easy for me to say I'm a sangha. I'm not attached to these things. Even emotionally, I can talk about objects. Most of the things in the world I'm not attached to. In other words, their presence or absence doesn't hurt me. I'm a sangha. I have no attachment to those objects on an emotional level. I can even say, I'm a sangha. I'm not even attached to my mind, the different vrittis in my mind, because I can let them come and go. That's shama, right? I can let them come. So this is how we use this word attachment. Now, what we're trying to do then is to get to what is the deepest point of asangatvam, of non-attachment. And that would be, when we do the Drik Drisha of Viveka, what we're trying to do is objectify, differentiate myself from anything that can be objectified. There are certain logics for this. Like, for instance, let me just give you a really simple one. And this is all, we're trying to just work with the reality of my own presence here in the room. Here I am in the room. If I can objectify something, like a thought in my mind, and I can watch that thought come into being and leave, as all thoughts do, I must necessarily be a sangha in reference to that thought. Why? Because the thought comes and goes and I don't. It's just very, very simple. That's an anvaya vyatireka. Here's the anvaya. The thought is, I am. The vyatireka would have to be, the thought is gone and I am gone. Therefore, I am the thought. The thought is, I am. The thought is gone, I am. I am the thought. But that's not our experience. Our experience is, the thought is, I am. The thought is gone, I still am. The mood is, I am. The mood is gone, I still am. Right? So this anvaya vyatireka allows me to differentiate my experience. Anything that I can objectify, anything that I can watch change. Now this is interesting. There isn't anything in the creation that doesn't change. Right? There's nothing in the creation that doesn't change. There's nothing about your body that doesn't change. There's nothing about your sense organs that don't change. There's nothing about your mind that doesn't change. There's nothing about the ahankara that doesn't change. In all of the upadis, every experience that you have is an experience of changing condition in terms of your body, your mind, your sense organs. Your being, the me, is always there before, during, and after that changing condition. Experientially, I'm talking. If that's the case, then there is no reason why your mind can't make the differentiation between the changeless and the changing. Because the changeless is always there. You're always there. So now the thing is, you have to go through this methodology to recognize that which is not changing, yourself, which is always present. But now this is the thing. If yourself is always present and everything else is changing, then you have to be a sangha, not attached to whatever is changing, because it comes and goes and you're still here. You see, that's a simple logic, really. But this very simple logic has staggering implications, because if you are can differentiate the Atma from this body which is objectified, and your thoughts which are objectified, your emotions which are objectified and changing, even the I thought which is objectified and changing, if you can objectify all of these things, then you're not these things. If you're not these things, they don't contain you. Just like the pot, that the cup doesn't contain space. You see that? There's nothing to contain you, because you're not them. They're objectified, they're coming and going. They don't contain you at all. If they don't contain you, then what shape are you? What size are you? You have nothing to do with shape or size anymore. Shape and size all belongs to the things that are changing in the creation. So then the question is going to come in, what is the relationship between this changeless me that isn't contained by anything and all of these things that I'm experiencing? That's what has to be understood. Because otherwise I'm left as this changeless being who is not contained by all of this that is changing. But what is all of this that is changing? What's the relationship?
Right? Yeah, I'm lost.
Yeah. So then we have to go back out into the creation and figure out, what is all this stuff that's here that we're experiencing? Is it something away from me, or is it mitya? That's what it amounts to. If it's something away from me, then there's a real creation out here separate from me. If it's mitya, what that means is, like the ocean and water, this creation of name and form that's being experienced has no being separate from me. Now, the thing is, to say that this creation that you experience is it is, it is, it is, it is, it is, has a being separate from you, you have to be able to prove that. And to prove that, you have to be able, first of all, to do the impossible. First of all, you have to show a thing, one thing, which you can't do. Because everything in this creation is infinitely divisible. So there is no such thing as a thing in the creation. And there's another problem, that absolutely everything in the creation comes into existence and goes out of existence. That means it's bordered by non-existence, everything in the creation. Nor do you ever experience any being other than your own amness. And so what you start to realize as you dissect this creation, that the self of this creation, the being of this creation, the sat of the creation, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is not a separate sat. It's not a separate existence. It's the existence that you are. And so that's why he says here, this, like the Jagan Mithya, the Asangatvam of oneself, both of these things have to be seen. Both of these have to be understood. If both are understood, then Kasya Kamaya, what is myself desiring? For the sake of whom am I desiring something? For whose sake? Who is the desirer? And who is the desirer, and what does the desirer mean? What is the desirer exactly in this situation? The desire, and this is what he's going to go into now, we'll do it next week. The desire is not, can't be the Asanga Atma, right? It can't be what we call the Kutasthi, because it's changeless. So there's no bhokta there. It can't be what we call the chidabhasa, the reflected consciousness in the mind, because the reflection of consciousness, the chidabhasa, the mind, can't even have any existence without the substance you know, the kutastha atma. So then you have to say, well, is it going to be, maybe the desire or the one who desires is a combination of the two. Well, yeah, it's a combination of the two. But upon analysis, we'll find that of those two, one is satyam and one is nitya. One is like the wave, the other is the water. So that's how everything is going to always resolve into the satyam. So he's going to go into a big analysis now on...
The satyam brings the desire up.
The satyam is the truth of the
desire.
The atma. But the satyam is not a desirer. Desirer means that there's duality.
Oh.
Yeah. See, if you have a desire, if you say, I'm a bhokta, I'm a desirer, then there's the desirer and the desired, right? Or there's a state of experience. That can't be there. That's not the nature of the atma. So the state of experience of the desirer is nitya. So anyway, we have to go into that. So it's a little whatever it is. It's good enough for now. Let's meditate.
I'll soon go home.
Om Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnamevavashishyate Om Shanti 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 Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Hari Om.
Do you know what what to me is very strange is that this unattached awareness, it's non-dual, which is myself, which is me, seems still to be there's no upadhi there, and so it's not contained, but it feels that way.
That's the question is very good, because you gave the wave example, so you cannot say the wave does not contain the water.
Yeah, of course the wave ocean has some limitations. So let me tell you what the limitation of the wave ocean.
Well, that wasn't okay.
Yes, it is.
Okay.
It is the problem that you're facing.
All right, good. Thank you.
Yeah, no, your question is good.
We always think, even using the wave ocean example, the problem is that the ocean water takes up space, right? Like the water itself takes up space, so the water is filling this wave, and then more water is needed to fill this wave, and a lot of water is needed to fill the ocean. And so water, in that illustration, water is spatial. But what that illustration is meant to show is that there's nothing there but water. But if you go too much into the illustration, you get the spatial aspect of water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you use the space illustration, there's another problem of space pervading objects, and the spaces as though stretching out, It's pervading through objects. The objects are existing in space, right? But here, for the Atma, the self is free of space. There is no space. Space is what belongs to the creation. So from the standpoint of the Atma, your being, it's not big, it's not small, it's not pervading out through the creation. Right? When we think of space, we think of space as non-dual in a sense. I mean, it's homogeneous, right? Mm-hmm. But we see that it pervades out. It is the size of the creation, right? Space is the size of the creation. It's pervasive to the creation. It's the size of the creation. Atma is not the size of the creation. Atma has nothing to do with size. So it's in this sense, wherever the creation is, the Atma is. But from the standpoint of the creation, the Atma doesn't become big to fill the creation, or small. It doesn't become big or small. It doesn't become expansive or less expansive, because the Atma has nothing to do with space or time. And so that means that your self-experience now, when you say me, that me is absolutely complete. It's not big, it's not small. It's not high or low, it's not expansive. It is only me. Right? Now, when we look at this me, which has nothing to do with size or space or dimension, from the standpoint of the creation, which does have space, right? When the creation comes, space, air, fire, water, earth, space and dimension all come with the creation. Okay? So now you have what the self, which has no dimension, nothing to do with dimension, and the creation that has no being apart from the self. But that creation has dimension. Right? So there's two things happening at the same time. Your being, which is free of dimension, just me, and the creation, which from its own standpoint is not away from me. And so I can say, I pervade the creation. But if I say words like that, I pervade the creation, you have to understand that that's only from the standpoint of within the creation, because there's nothing within the creation that is away from you. So let me look at it like this. If I say, okay, close your eyes and imagine a beautiful meadow with mountains and sky, okay? Now you haven't, your me, the me, hasn't now gone and pervaded this imaginary meadow. It hasn't done anything. It hasn't moved. And it has nothing to do with the space of the meadow or the sky. It hasn't become the space of the meadow or the sky. It hasn't filled the... It hasn't filled, gone out and filled the sky, right? However, if from within the imagination of the meadow and the sky, I'm talking, I can say, wherever the sky is, I am. Wherever the meadow is, I am. Now here, wherever the universe is, I am. Right? Which is true, because this multidimensional creation has no... I am its rock. I am its being. I am its being. But for me, there's no dimension. The dimension belongs from within the Maya of the creation. So within that Maya, there's no separate. There's no nothing away from me. Okay, so now when that's understood, if you're kind of grasping that, now sit in this experience right now, in this room, with your body, with your mind, your sense organs, the eye thought, and you. The me is here. Okay? So now, from the standpoint of yourself, there is no dimension. From the standpoint of the creation, there's nothing away from you. Because everything in your experience, from the standpoint of this room, everything in this room is. It has been. But the being it has is not a being that you can objectify. The being that you give to this room has no dimension. Being has no dimension. It's just the being is me, the me experience, which is a non-dimensional experience. Non-dimensional means what? I am, but I'm not big or small. These words don't apply. I am. But I'm not tall or short or big or small. I'm not red or black or yellow.
So we're really talking about something that it's this meanness is really doesn't have anything to do with the body or the thinking or your me or my me.
That's right. It doesn't have anything to do with it. Your me or my me, there's only one me.
Yeah.
And the me you enjoy is your me.
And that's what
is the one we're talking about.
Right.
The me that you enjoy is your me.
Yeah.
Is the me we're talking about. It's just that the me is me too. There's only
one
me.
That's the part that's hard to.
The only reason it's hard is because you don't recognize the asangatvam of your self experience.
Mm-hmm.
The me experience that makes you that you label as Edward,
mm-hmm.
and you think belongs to this body,
mm-hmm.
that me experience is you. That is you. But if I take Edward,
it's all the yous.
There's only one. It is you, but there's only one of us.
Because it's self-evident.
Exactly.
And so it's self-evident. And so what's the mind going to say? That's, you know, it just...
It is its own experience.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the me experience belongs to the me,
yeah.
to the Atma. The me experience where you that makes you, you. Mm-hmm. That is the self-evident experience of the self. And so when you get rid of the body, that me experience is unchanged because of Sangha. You get rid of the mind, the me is unchanged. You get rid of the ahankara, me is unchanged. You get rid of the universe, me is unchanged. Because it's a Sangha, it doesn't belong. It's not contained. It's the self of everything.
And there's no ownership, there's no particular...
There's no ownership because there's nothing else.
But Carol, in the temple, the deity is there. So, is there concentrated self?
Concentrated sukshma sharira, subtle body.
Okay.
Yeah.
So then that experience, what is that experience compared to the me experience?
Well, that's like the me experience of the Lord in the temple.
Mm.
Is this me experience. There's not a different me. There's only one me. The me experience of Ishwara is this. The me experience of you is Ishwara. Is Ishwara's me experience. There's only one me experience. And that is the me experience.
But in the temple, the deity is different from me.
No, not from you, the Atma.
Not the Atma.
Yeah. There's only one me experience. The me experience of Ishwara is your me experience. The me experience of the Devata is yours. The me experience of the cat is your me experience. There's only one me experience.
Mm-hmm.
And the me experience is aparoksha, it's self-evident, you know.
But to have a me experience, there has to be a mind.
No.
No, I'm not saying that, but what I'm saying, in a sense, to label an experience as me.
Yes,
there has to be a mind to label that experience as me.
Yeah.
And then, so but like the chair isn't labeling its experience as me, the being of the chair isn't saying the being that I am, you know what I mean? And the chair doesn't have a mind. So
right.
It can't say that.
But you know what? Mm-hmm. That's true. Mm-hmm. The chair's not going to say I am the Atma.
Right.
And the rug's not going to say, I'm the Atma, but the Jnani will say, I am the Atma.
Yeah.
But the Atma, whether the Upadhi is a chair, or a rug, or a cat, or a human being,
mm-hmm.
the Atma, it remains the same.
Yeah.
The the human, the person's ability to say, I am the Atma, doesn't change the Atma experience. It doesn't do anything. And the chair's not saying it doesn't do anything either. I mean, the Atma doesn't become greater because of it being in a human being's comment on it, or a chair's non-comment. You see what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I guess kind of what I'm saying is when we say me, I mean, in some ways that's really good, but then in another way, it isn't good.
It depends. You have to. All language is problematic like that, isn't it?
Yeah, but so I you think have that problem of language, when you say yourself and myself,
that's also a problem.
That's a big one, you know.
But we're always.
That really grabs me.
In teaching,
yeah,
we're always juggling and juxtaposing these words to try to break through the limitation of the words, because the words are taking place in duality. So we're always juggling these words, pointing
mm-hmm. yeah.
to what the words mean.
Yeah.
Now, the one reason I like the word me is because I like to use the word me, because when you do recognize the nature of Brahman, what you recognize is that's me. That it is me. What I had taken myself to be, I had taken the me,
mm-hmm.
what I really am most identified with as me, I had taken that to be this body-mind complex. That that's what makes me, me. And then Brahman is something else to be experienced.
Mm-hmm.
But what you realize is that no, the very me that you have taken to be you, the body-mind sense organs, it is that most intimate me that is Brahman, you know? And it is that me that is self-evident. So I play with this word because I think it's a powerful word.
But what you don't recognize is that this me that's self-evident and is distinct from the body-mind. But what you don't recognize initially, at least, is that it's the being of everything.
Well, but that is what has to end up being recognized,
yeah.
you know? That's the whole satya mitya. That's where we. That's
so that's where you truly get your identity then. I mean, Durga is saying that.
See, I mean, you need to recognize yourself, differentiated from this, and then you have to recognize that this self that you are is the self of this.
So maybe that's why, at a certain point, the word me is almost.
Is
not useful because
isness.
It keeps you it because it keeps like a, as if a separate identity because with the pronouns me you it, you know
yeah I know but that it's totally always playing with the language and that's why Swamiji will go to kind of counteract that the wall is the rug is I is
yeah.
or the wall am. The rug, you heard him do this, the wall am, the rug am, I am.
Yes.
To show that there's only one amness.
Or just being, maybe just like the word being.
You can, but the problem is, yes, these words can be used, but really you have to juggle to make the student see. Because now the problem with being is that being is an abstract. And so there's a big difference usually between being and me.
Yeah.
If you can see that to bring the being and me together,
mm-hmm.
so that when we're talking about being, we're talking about the being that I am. So all again, it's all...
Yeah, so I'm just trying to think of a way to depersonalize the Atma in some sense, to understand that...
That's impossible, isn't it?
Well, no, because you can use the sat. That's where Swamiji will say,
right.
You can, in a sense, depersonalize, recognizing that this... And this is this isness.
Right, because that's where you have to go.
Well, you have to be careful.
Mm-hmm.
Even that, because if you depersonalize, to me, I am this. So the amness has to extend.
Yeah.
It's not that this is amness and me, and this is isness and it.
Yeah.
So the amness that you are is the amness of this.
Well, when we say extend, you know, then again, somehow to me, that seems like this sort of like that this idea of the Atma being contained, and then somehow we have to extend it, and I have a feeling that isn't quite right, because again, then to me, that's kind of like spatial.
But that's just what I was talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like the there's the space within the creation.
Yeah.
There's not space from the standpoint of the self.
Yeah.
So what has to happen is that, and yet, this space, is there's no part of this creation that's away from the self. And so that's why we say the self is all pervasive. You know, we have these words, the self is all pervasive. But if you say all pervasive, then you're talking from within the creation. There's no place where the self is not. But then to recognize your experience that involves satyamitta, the experience that involves yourself and the manifestation of the creation, the atma and the manifestation of the creation. The recognition of the self, if you're looking for it to pervade, the self is actually free from space. And so then there's a subtle nuance there. You know, because then you don't want to make yourself spatial, and at the same time there's nothing away from you. So that I'm actually describing, pointing to something that you can actually recognize in your experience.
Yeah.
So it's just words trying to make those words land on, you know, the experience that you're actually having in a way that you can say, oh, that's what she means.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We should do some meditations on those things.
That would be nice, yeah.
Yeah, that would be nice.
Carol?
Yeah.
Does the Atma experience, or is it just our conscious being that has experience, because the Atma just is.
The Atma is the conscious being.
So it does go through experiences.
No, the experiences, any experience that comes and goes is nitya.
Hmm.
Is so, it contained in the Atma?
Well, nitya isn't contained in anything, because the nitya can never be away from the Atma. Just like...
Can I say nitya doesn't exist? Okay, that's it.
No, because here we are experiencing it.
Oh.
But you can't say it has any independent existence. Like, you wouldn't say that the waves have an independent existence from the water. You can't say they don't exist, but they're not independent. That's what mitya means. It's not it's there to be discussed, but it has no being of its own. So here's this creation to be dealt with for us to talk about. It has no being of its own. Apart from the satyam.
And it's changing all the time.
It's changing all the time. But you're not.
Yeah.
And that's what needs to be. And that what is not changing is absolutely, there's nothing that is changing that is away from what is not changing. What is not changing is the satyam, is the conscious being. That is you. And that stable you needs to be, the mind needs to recognize. That in all experience, the stable you is there as the very self of every experience. The very being of every experience, that's it, and that is stable. So the stability is absolutely pervasive. There's nothing in the creation that's away from the stability of your being. And that's what needs to be seen.
See, that sounds so, so very, very simple and graspable. And yet, is it that? I mean, you know.
Oh.
I guess it's not time to go over.
Thank you, offended.
That's the end. Well, we'll pick up next time.
Right where we left off.